from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The National Fish Habitat Action Plan has selected Diamond Lake in northwest Iowa as one of the 10 waters to watch for this year. In the first half hour, we'll find out what that means from biologist Mike Hawkins and Mike McGee of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources. Then we'll explore the connection between cancer and the environment with biologist and cancer survivor Sandra Steingraber. She's been compared to Rachel Carson. An updated edition of her book, Living Downstream, has just been published. The book has also inspired a new documentary film about Steingraber's quest to find the environmental causes of cancer. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. So glad you could join us over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This hour, we look at our environment and its effects on us. Later in the hour, we'll explore the connection between our environment and cancer with biologist and cancer survivor Sandra Steingraber. But first, the National Fish Habitat Action Plan has selected Diamond Lake, that's in northwest Iowa, as one of the 10 waters to watch for this year. The 2010 10 Waters to Watch list is a collection of rivers, streams, lakes, watershed systems, and shores in our country that will benefit from strategic conservation efforts to protect, restore, or enhance their current condition. Joining us now to talk about this specific lake, this program, and more generally a little bit later about the quality of Iowa's lakes and rivers, Mike Hawkins. He's with the DNR. He's a biologist supervising the Diamond Lake Restoration. Mike Hawkins, welcome to our program.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you on us, on our program. Mike McGee is with us as well. He's with the DNR, and he's involved with the Lake Restoration Project, coordinator for that, which we'll talk about a little bit later as well. Mike McGee, welcome to our program.
Good to hear from you.
Let's start with you, Mike Hawkins. Describe those who are not familiar with Diamond Lake, its location, and what kind of lake it is.
Well, it's a prairie pothole lake, what we would call a prairie pothole lake up here in northwest Iowa. It's in Dickinson County. In fact, it's not too far from the Minnesota border, but it's typical of some of our shallow natural lakes that we find across northwest Iowa. It was, those lakes were created about 12,000, 14,000 years ago by the last Wisconsin glacier that came across portions of Iowa and created the Des Moines Lobe and stretched all the way down there to Des Moines.
Mm-hmm. How big is it?
It's about 166 acres, so it's not a real big natural lake compared to some of our bigger lakes like Spirit Lake and West Okoboji, but it typifies some of these prairie pothole lakes in size and depth, maximum depth of probably about 6 foot, maybe 7 foot deep in some spots.
Maximum depth at 6 or 7 feet. So,
yep.
So it's very, very shallow.
It is, and it's kind of classified as one of those tweener lakes. It was kind of a term that was coined in Wisconsin and Minnesota to describe a lake that isn't quite deep enough to maybe be classified as a lake, but it's not shallow enough to really be classified as a wetland or a marsh. And so kind of gets the in-between status.
Mm-hmm. So looking at the waters to watch that were selected this year, they're all over the country, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Wyoming, Colorado, even up in Alaska. Why was Diamond Lake selected?
Well, I think probably a combination of factors. One is that we had some pretty good support for this project as projects go. Ducks Unlimited was a big partner. So was the Dickinson County Clean Water Alliance, an alliance of local agencies and public and private organizations in Dickinson County that strive for clean water and water quality projects in Dickinson County lakes. And also between our lake restoration program within Department of Natural Resources and our Wildlife and Fisheries Bureaus, we had great all-around support for this project. And then secondly, partnership is one thing, but secondly, this is and was kind of the kickoff or inaugural project for Iowa in restoring some of these shallow lakes, shallow natural lakes that have really, for the most part, in Iowa and across the Midwest, exhibited very poor water quality. I haven't lived up to the expectation that we might have for a lake like that, and and really have been, kind of mediocre all around when it comes to wildlife and fisheries habitat and water quality.
You mentioned that this lake was formed during the last glacial period. So take us back to the last glacial period, but to when it was pristine, before it was contaminated or degraded, and then tell us what happened.
We do have some notes from the early 1900s when Pommel actually came across the state of Iowa, one of the botanists, and you'll see buildings named or a building named for him down at Iowa State University. But he was a researcher that worked on classifying and looking at aquatic plants and systems across the state, and he has some notes classified a number of or identified a number of aquatic plant species, both emergent and submergent. So those plants that are in the water, that grow above the water, like bulrush, cattail, and some other sedges and things, but also some underwater plants, coontail and some others that grow underwater. But it had identified a number of those. And so we believe from some of these notes that Diamond Lake must have been in a clear water condition. It had very clear water. Had good aquatic plant diversity and probably a pretty diverse fish community as well. But along with that comes insects and zooplankton and all those other good things that we'd expect in a healthy lake.
Mm-hmm. And then pick up the story. What happened to get it to the condition it is today?
Well, there's a number of things that happened. Two major impacts that have affected our natural lakes in Iowa are increased drainage. Every lake has a watershed, or that land that drains to the lake. And really, you can't look at a lake without also examining that land that drains to it. It's a product of that water that comes off the landscape. And so we've had these massive changes in the watershed, or it's about 18,000 acres that drain to Diamond Lake. And those changes have had some pretty dramatic impacts, sending more water quicker through a lot of drainage and drainage tile, but also sediment nutrients that have flooded into Diamond Lake. The second major change or introduction that occurred was back in the late 1800s. Somebody had the bright idea to bring common carp to the United States, and it didn't work out so good. It was an introduction that has been plaguing folks for a lot of years since their introduction. And common carp are really good at rooting up the bottom, rooting up those aquatic plants, and causing some pretty poor water quality conditions in lakes across the state and across the Midwest. And in fact, across the world, Australia battles common carp as much as the United States does.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the watershed, are we saying farm chemicals perhaps contributing to this too?
Well, probably not so much chemicals. That could play a role. The biggest issue that we battle in streams and lakes in the state of Iowa is just excess sediment and nutrients, especially in the form of phosphorus, which is the limiting nutrient for many of our aquatic systems. In other words, we only get as much productivity out of a lake as we have phosphorus. And so as you add phosphorus to a system, you get more and more productivity. Productivity is good to a point, and then it becomes a problem. And you can get excess algae blooms and nuisance blue-green algaes and some of the things that we don't necessarily would attribute to a healthy ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. So what is being done now that Diamond Lake has been named one of the 10 waters to watch? What is the goal here and what's being done?
Well, and this project started a few years ago in cooperation with all of our partners. In 2006, the construction began. And to maybe explain the process that a natural lake maybe historically would have gone through, it was a better place to start. These shallow natural lakes, during dry periods or drought periods, would have gone almost dry. And most folks would maybe think of that as being a bad thing, but actually in the life of a natural lake, that's a good cycle to go through. Many of the beneficial aquatic plants and animals depend on those drought cycles to actually rejuvenate. A number of aquatic plants, actually, their seeds don't germinate unless they have that dry period. That dry period actually triggers their germination cycle.
Can't be good for the fish, though, can it?
It can't. A number of the native species had evolved to be in these drought conditions during times. And fish, some of the fish populations would have been wiped out during a drought, but would have quickly recolonized and repopulated from downstream sources. And so the drought cycle was really a natural cycle that these systems went through long before humans were here, and was real important for some of these aquatic plants. And so this project, like many other shallow lake projects across the Midwest, aims at kind of reproducing or reenacting that drought period. And we've got to do that for a couple reasons. One is that increased drainage, all that extra water that's coming through. Even during dry times, these shallow natural lakes don't get the chance to have those dry periods. And then the other big thing is those common carp. And a dry period, just like you alluded to, can't be good for fish. Well, it isn't good for common carp. And really, it can basically reset the lake and allow for the eradication of those common carp. And then as the lakes come back, we can restock with some native fish and restart the system, and then put the some fish barriers and things downstream that kind of block those common carp from recolonizing.
So one of your goals would be to wipe out the common carp population at Diamond Lake.
It is, and we've done that. In 2006, we initiated construction of a drawdown tube, which actually a perforated tube that extends out towards the center of the lake and outletted it downstream and put a water level control structure in between on the tube system, and allowed us to start dewatering or pulling water off of the system to simulate that drought. And that was done for about 2 years. We worked on that project for about 2 years and tried to keep water off of it. Mother Nature didn't help the situation in the first year. We had quite a bit of rain that first summer, and so our aquatic plants didn't get a chance to germinate. But the second year was an amazing transformation. And, you know, the lake bed looked dry and it cracked and looked like a desolate place. But, a few weeks later, the aquatic plants sprouted all around. The place just became very lush. Shorebirds it was an amazing response from birds and migratory type birds that were coming through that use that particular habitat that you might not think of. And so we got that great germination period for those plants. And then in the after the growing season, the spring of 2009, we started to allow water to refill and start to flood those plants back. And we had increases in waterfowl counts, not just those game waterfowl, but waterfowl in general and aquatic birds, a 40-fold increase in the numbers of those species that were using the area.
Mike Hawkins, we have to take a short break.
Sure.
We'll be back. A DNR biologist supervising Diamond Lake, the Diamond Lake Restoration up in northwest Iowa, listed as one of the 10 waters to watch for this year by the National Fish Habitat Action Plan. And when we come back, also with Mike McGee of the DNR, we'll widen our discussion, talk about other area lakes. What have you experienced in Iowa's lakes and rivers and streams as an angler or boater that encourages you, that concerns you? 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking in our first half hour about Iowa's lakes and rivers, about Diamond Lake in northwest Iowa, one of 10 waters to watch for this year, with Mike Hawkins, a DNR biologist, also Mike McGee of the DNR, a lake restoration project. Let's talk about the wider significance of this, Iowa's lakes and rivers. Can you pick up on this, Mike McGee? We have a program in Iowa called the Lake Restoration Project, which you are the coordinator of. How does this fit in?
Correct. Well, Diamond Lake is one of those that we're very interested in and we provided some funding for. But as we look to the state of Iowa, we worked closely with Iowa State University, their limnology department that works on water quality issues, and additionally the Center for Ag and Rural Development CARD at Iowa State, and we had them do some survey work. And we found that 6 out of 10 Iowans visit lakes each year, and they visited them multiple times. And statewide, our lakes generate annually $1.6 billion in spending by Iowans. And with that information in hand, we proposed an expanded lake restoration program to the state legislature back in 2006, and they've been providing us state dollars at an accelerated pace since 2006. We provided a game plan, a strategy, and how we'd kind of prioritize systems and move forward. To date, we've completed nearly 7 projects. Now, you have to still have a maintenance phase because you just don't do a lake restoration project and walk away from it. We have about 26 systems that are in progress and another 6 that are in the planning stage. And these projects can range from literally $100,000 to do the work that needs to be in the watershed and the lake, to some of them are going to exceed $10 million to get the restoration work completed.
Mm-hmm. So with the monies paid in for these restoration projects, and it's a fairly young project, what have you seen in terms of payoffs? I don't just mean financial payoffs, but what have been the results in terms of the restoration thus far?
Well, many times we will see a doubling or tripling in use at the lake when people are attracted to clear water and to good water quality. And so we'll see many times use at least double or triple. And the money that we invest in terms of payback to the local economy and to the state, we can have a payback in as little as 3 to 4 years sometimes on these lake restoration projects. So it's quite exceptional. We've been getting, on the average, about $8.6 million a year from the legislature, and then we combine that and leverage it with state dollars where possible. Unfortunately, right now, while we have some federal dollars we can leverage in the watershed, the in-lake work is pretty much on the local and the state's dime. We do not have a federal partner, and that's what we are desperately seeking and needing here. Many times federal policies have led to the deterioration of some of these systems there, so we'd just like a federal partner to help improve these.
Give us the names of some of the lakes and a quick profile of the ones that you name.
Well, great. Down in central Iowa near Des Moines, a project is completed as Lake Aquabie in Warren County, and there's a nice state park around it, Lake of Three Fires down in Taylor County. But right now we're involved in several major lake restoration projects in the north central and northwest part of the state, Clear Lake in Cerro Gordo County, and then Storm Lake over in Buena Vista County. And we're seeing some dramatic improvements in water quality, significant investments of time and money. And I might add that this program, a lot of times people are very leery, the government gets involved, that there's all these demands and it has to take place. This is voluntary. And we also require strong local involvement and support and voluntary participation for these projects to move along.
When you look at all these lakes that you have pegged for restoration in Iowa, are they all suffering from more or less the same problems, or are they very individual in the problems that they have?
There's usually the same basic problems, but there's 4 or 5 problems, but then each one of them has a different kind of percentage, you know, like the high phosphorus levels might be greater in one lake, or it could be the rough fish, it could be the watershed, it could be a turbidity or nutrients entering the lake. So it can vary from lake to lake, but it seems like there's about 4 or 5 issues that really center around most of our problems.
How has the project affected the recreation, the camping, boating, fishing, and the local economies in the restored areas?
Well, just great. Many times when we do work at some of our state lakes, or if we're working at a county conservation board system, when we do the lake restoration, sometimes they take an opportunity to also improve their facilities because you have some downtime sometimes when you're doing this restoration. And once everything gets back going again, we see tremendous camping numbers increase, people heading to the swimming beach, if there's a swimming beach there. Fishing just takes off at some of these systems, and we have a phenomenal fishing success, too. So it's just a combination of factors. The day use, picnicking, there's trails around the lake. People like to walk around a lake where the water looks clean and it smells great, and so we'll see the hiking trails get more use, too.
Are you suffering from the budget woes? Are you worried about the economy and the effect that it might have on these programs?
It has diminished some. We have received a reduced amount of what we had in previous years, 20% or so. We've garnered bipartisan support because everybody has a lake near their community and wants to see this happen. And this is one of these successful projects where you can see measurable results. So it's something we have to work hard with our local communities, everybody, to keep support. and hang on through these difficult times. We basically now have moved this program along to when it first started to really working at finding a number of good projects. Now we have way more projects waiting in the wings than we have dollars.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left. Can you give us, if someone's very interested in a lake, maybe someone visited a lake 5 years ago in Iowa and has had in that time a dramatic restoration, where would you go? What are you most proud of as a lake in Iowa that has been restored?
I think probably down in I used to work as a field fisheries biologist in southwest Iowa for over 25 years, and we had a lake that down there, Lake of Three Fires in southwest Iowa, that was built back in the WPA days, back in the 1930s. And I've looked at all the historical information and had water clarity down there most of the time that was about 12 inches. You could see 12 inches. If you had a really good stretch, you could see of a dry period of time, you'd see 18 inches down in the water. Marginal fishing. Now we have water clarity that averages 4 to 5.5 feet in the lake there. And so you walk into the water way past your waist, and you can wiggle your toes, and you can see them at the swimming beach, and the fishing's never been better. So I think from a perspective of a system that I worked on for a number of years and was frustrated with, and we finally did it, went in and did this lake restoration and watershed work, I might add there, we've really improved it.
Mm-hmm. So when we take Iowa's lakes as a whole, have we reached our low point, and we're now, in terms of water quality, reached a low point some years ago, and with this lake restoration, improving it?
We are slowly improving in some instances and holding our own in others. We do now have the tools in place. We know what it takes to improve these systems, and also we have improved abilities to do the analysis prior to it. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we've seen the poorest water and that we have some real chances to improve our water quality at our lakes around the state of Iowa.
What are the biggest obstacles for you in terms of getting to better water quality in more lakes?
Once we've established a funding base, a secure, stable funding base, projects are multiple-year projects, and so they require multiple-year funding. So, you know, it's tough to get into a five-year project if you only have money for year one. So the funding, and then we identify the problems, if it's sediment and nutrient delivery to the lake and how we go about tackling it. We don't go in and do in-lake restoration until we've tackled the work up in the watershed. We want long-term sustainability, and we don't want to be back into these systems for 40 to 50 years doing extensive renovation work. We can do some maintenance work, but we don't want to do these extensive restoration projects. So that's why we need to take care of work in the watershed prior to our in-lake work.
We've got just a few seconds left. To be clear, these are lakes on public lands, not private.
These are all public systems, yes. We do work on private land from a water quality watershed effort, but all the lakes we're working on have public access.
Okay, Mike McGee, thank you very much, the coordinator for the DNR's Lake Restoration Project. Thank you for being with us, Mike McGee.
Thank you.
And thanks to Mike Hawkins. We heard from him a little bit earlier, supervising the Diamond Lake Restoration in northwest Iowa. Thank you, Mike Hawkins.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we explore the connection between cancer and the environment with biologist and cancer survivor Sandra Steingraber. She's been compared to Rachel Carson. An updated edition of her book, Living Downstream, has just been published. The book has also inspired a new documentary film about Steingraber's quest to find the environmental causes of cancer. That's when we return in just a few minutes. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And The Exchange continues from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Sandra Steingraber. Steingraber grew up and spent most of her childhood just outside of Peoria, Illinois. Her mother was a microbiologist, her father a community college professor. 30 years ago, after just turning 20, Sandra Steingraber was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And in the just-published second edition of her 1997 book, Living Downstream, Steingraber thinks back to what that 20-year-old cancer patient had on her mind. I was hoping I would live long enough to have sex with someone. I hadn't done that yet, she writes. I could not have imagined, while lying in my hospital bed, exhaling anesthesia, that someday I could write, 30 years ago, I had cancer. Steingraber is the recipient of many honors. The Sierra Club heralded her as the new Rachel Carson. She is currently a columnist for Orion Magazine and a scholar in residence at Ithaca College. She is married and has two children. Sandra Steingraber joins us for the remainder of the hour by phone from Ithaca, New York. Welcome to The Exchange, Sandra.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you with us. For those not acquainted with your story, tell us how your cancer diagnosis at the age of 20 led to your interest in the environmental causes of cancer.
Well, I think my interest happened right at the hospital bed with questions that my diagnosing physician had for me. He wanted to know, had I ever smelted aluminum? Had I ever vulcanized tires? And, of course, I was a high-achieving Elks Club scholarship winner, biology major. Of course, I hadn't done those things. But his questions led me to believe that there must be an environmental link to my cancer. And when I went back to the university library, indeed, I discovered that bladder cancer is considered a quintessential environmental cancer with many known links to certain kinds of chemicals, especially those derived from coal. I also discovered that even though we have absolute proof about the cancer-causing potential of some of these chemicals, that there's nothing in our laws that automatically prohibits them from being used. And I guess that came as a big shock to me. I was also adopted, and my identity as an adoptee was also pivotal here because I was not the first in my family to have cancer. My mother, in fact, was struggling with metastatic breast cancer while I was being diagnosed, so we were actually co-cancer patients together. Mm-hmm. And my aunt died of the same kind of bladder cancer that I had. Now, if I had not known I was adopted, I might just presume that cancer ran in my genes. But as a biologist, I became very interested in what else families had in common, such as the environment, and then that became my life's work.
The updated edition of your book, Living Downstream, has just been published, and the book has also inspired a new documentary film called Living Downstream. I want to play a short clip of it, and this is the beginning where you tell a short parable.
There was once a village along a river. The people who lived here were very kind. These residents, according to parable, began noticing increasing numbers of drowning people caught in the river's swift current. And so they went to work, devising ever more elaborate technologies to resuscitate them. So preoccupied were these heroic villagers with rescue and treatment that they never thought to look upstream to see who was pushing the victims in. This is a walk up that river.
So your view then was that we're preoccupied with rescue and treatment in heroic ways. Has your view changed since at that point?
I think things are changing a little bit. We certainly have seen, for example, in all the public discussion around childhood obesity, which we know is, of course, a driver of all kinds of long-term chronic diseases, including cancer, that we need to take an upstream approach to obesity, and that means more than just telling kids to go outside and stop eating dessert. It means changes in the built environment, how we offer food choices, whether there are sidewalks, you know, allowing children to walk to school. And my hope is that the same kind of upstream approach can also be taken to cancer more widely, so that we begin to ask, for example, you know, look, cancer is the most expensive disease that you can have. It's one of the diseases that is threatening to sink our healthcare economy, and therefore preventing cancer rather than just racing for its cure is an imperative need. And if we have evidence demonstrating that certain chemicals raise the risk for certain cancer, then maybe we need to divorce our dependency on those chemicals, both because it's a human rights issue, which is what I argue, but also because it's an economic one. And in fact, investments in green chemistry and green engineering, clean energy sources are investments in cancer prevention as well.
Your book, Living Downstream, brought together two categories of information, as we've been talking about, the data on environmental contamination and the data on cancer. Tell us, you grew up in, is it Tazewell County, Illinois?
That's it.
Now, you did write a lot about this in the book. Now, this is the area you grew up in, a rural area near Peoria, farmland, not much different than most of Iowa, most of where our listeners are. Tell us about the environmental carcinogens, the contaminations you found in and around your hometown that would be of most interest to our listeners.
Right. Well, I should say, I guess, here that Living Downstream really is two books in one, so it does represent my best attempt as a biologist to summarize, I hope in plain-spoken English, the evidence that we do have linking environmental contaminants to cancer. But it's also a love story, and it's a memoir, and that narrative is woven in and around the science. And for that, I actually moved back home to my sister's basement in Tazewell County, Illinois, where I grew up and became a kind of environmental detective there. So although I am just one data point in the elevated rates of cancer in my community, I wanted to reveal some of the other lives behind the data points. And those include people who grew up in an industrialized area right along the Illinois River. Cancer rates are high there, and the toxics release inventory is impressively high. I discovered what kind of toxic chemicals were in the drinking water wells, and they include both chemicals from some of the industries that are in the river valley, but also farm chemicals in the flood, you know, from used in the floodplains where we grow a lot of corn and bean agriculture. And indeed, the house my father built on the east bluff of that river, if you looked out the back door, you could see the smokestacks of the various different industries along the river. If you looked out the front door to the east, that was where the corn and bean fields lie, and also my own family's farm. My mother grew up on a farm in central Illinois, and in fact, my cousin, who's my age, still farms there. And so part of the book is also a conversation between my cousin and me over chemicals such as atrazine, which my cousin is a user of as a production ag kind of farmer, and which I happen to believe should be abolished. And yet we love each other, and we both believe deeply in agroecology and farming, and both see ourselves as stewards of the land. And so that conversation is part of the book as well.
Sandra Steingraber is my guest if you've just joined us. She's a biologist, cancer survivor, author of Living Downstream, has just been published in its second edition. She writes and lectures on the environmental factors that contribute to reproductive health problems and environmental links to cancer. If you'd like to join our conversation with a question or a comment, or share a worry that you have about an environmental contamination where you live, join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Sandra, you write in your book that six trends have emerged in our understanding of the environment's contribution to cancer since you came out with that first edition. Let's go through some of those.
Okay.
Tell us, what do you see as most significant, first of all?
Well, I think certainly we know that cancer causation is complicated. Any one tumor can have many causes, and some of those causes can be found in the environment. In fact, there's a whole new field of biological study that has emerged in the time between the first edition in 1997 and this current one, and that's a field called epigenetics, which shows us there's actually another layer of instructions on top of our genes whose job it is to take environmental signals streaming in from the outside world and help decide which genes should be turned on and allowed to speak and which genes should be silenced. And so our genes are now no longer thought anymore to be the kind of master molecule, but rather they're thought to be kind of like the keys of a piano. You know, you can play jazz or you can play Bach, but the difference is not in the keyboard, it's in the hands of the pianist. So really, it's the environment.
So what does that tell us about, we all have, in your area around Peoria, in our area, wherever we live, we have certain environmental carcinogens there. What determines whether one person gets cancer and another one doesn't?
I think a lot depends on the inherited vulnerabilities that we bring to bear, of course. Unfortunately, we can't do anything about who our ancestors are, but it's really the interaction between those genes and the environment that produces cancer risk. And of course, we can do everything about the environment. So that I think that's why the whole topic of the environment's link to cancer is actually a very hopeful one. And I embrace, of course, and this is the sixth trend I talk about in the book, the precautionary principle is a kind of normative guide to help us make these decisions. We all have different genes. We all are exposed at different times in our life cycle. It really swamps the ability of science to explain exactly who will be at risk and how. And so in the face of all that uncertainty, we really need to protect life when substantive proof isn't available to us yet. And I'm happy to inform Iowa listeners that the headquarters for North America's sort of premier think tank on the precautionary principle is located right in Iowa. And Ames, Iowa is the center for the Science and Environmental Health Network, headed up by Carolyn Raffensperger. And her husband, by the way, Fred Kirschenbaum, is there at the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. And so Iowa itself, through these two wonderful institutions, is enacting the precautionary principle in its policies. And some of the fine universities there are kind of serving as a laboratory for precautionary ideas that are really serving as a model for the rest of the nation.
Who are the individuals who claim who would tend to dismiss the links between cancer and environmental contamination that you've run into, and why do they do it?
Well, I think they come from a lot of sources. There are certainly industry has a stake in defending its products and therefore often engages in a familiar tactic for anybody who has ever followed the tobacco wars, which is to deny and discount the evidence as long as possible and try to create doubt where others might see an emerging body of knowledge that should be acted upon. And so this is certainly part of the problem. I think that our cancer advocacy organizations are also strangely slow to respond to the emerging evidence for a link between cancer and the environment. I have an article it's about to be published on Huffington Post, where I really call out the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure on its reluctance to speak to its constituents about the environment's link to especially breast cancer and especially atrazine. And I have a particular feel close to that organization because Susan G. Komen herself is from Peoria, as is her sister Nancy Brinker. So I want Susan G. Komen for the Cure to come back to Peoria and talk to us about atrazine and its demonstrated links to various kinds of cancer and its possible links to cancers, including perhaps breast cancer. I think they should be on the forefront of this conversation. Some organizations certainly are. We have some wonderful breast cancer organizations, Breast Cancer Fund and Breast Cancer Action in San Francisco, for example, the Women's Community Cancer Project in Boston, who have been provided really good analysis of the link between women's cancers and environmental exposures and are really making a difference in the way science is conducted, just as the AIDS activists of the 1980s insisted that virology research be directed down new research pathways that would save lives even in the absence of absolute proof. And I have seen working with scientists in the study sections where grant proposals are examined and we decide what we're going to fund, that actually women's cancer activists who are gotten very smart about the environmental evidence are really redirecting research dollars in a way that I think will shed even more light on this question.
Jassy is joining us from Indianola. Welcome to the program, Jassy.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm really excited to speak to Sandra Steingraber today because I use her book in my class. The Having Faith, an Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood, has been really helpful in how I teach my students about embryology and the environment.
Well, that's really nice to hear. I guess I should say here that I became a cancer patient at 20, but a mother on the brink of 40, which I know isn't the usual way that people live their lives. But my very joyful experience at becoming pregnant and having a daughter, Faith, who's now 11 and a half, became the topic of a book called Having Faith, named after her. And that led me into the field of fetal toxicology and a look at the way the environment affects embryonic development and child development. And that's a tack I'm continuing, actually. My current book project in the works here is to take a look at the ecology of family life and examine the threats to children all the way up to and including puberty. And I'm especially looking closely at the ability of chemicals like certain pesticides and plastics to actually alter the timing and tempo of sexual maturation in girls.
Mm-hmm. Jassy, may I ask where you teach?
I teach at Simpson College. The course that I teach is called The Biology of Women, and I'm really looking forward to reading more about precocious puberty and some of the environmental impacts that might be playing a role here, so I'm very much looking forward
to it. Oh, I'm glad. I do have a white paper I just published a couple years ago you could easily find if you just Google Steingraber and puberty. I'm sure you'll find it. It's a fascinating topic, and I should say here that I'm really interested in engaging the Right to Life community in some of the new research I'm doing, because first of all, although I'm not a member of the Right to Life community, both of my feet are firmly planted in the pro-choice community. Many members of my apostolic Christian family, who are still farming in the farming community in Illinois, are members of that community, and they feel very strongly about the sanctity of fetal life. And I have evidence suggesting that, I've looked at evidence that suggests that certain farm chemicals have the power to interfere with embryonic implantation and sabotage a pregnancy. And so what I'm arguing here is that abortion means a lot more than a woman just walking into a Planned Parenthood clinic. It also can mean chemicals that cause spontaneous abortions, and some of these are used here in the Midwest, and we might want to have a conversation about that. Even though we could disagree on other kinds of abortion, maybe we could agree that chemicals with the power to extinguish a human pregnancy have no role to play in our farm economy.
Thank you for that call from Indianola. There are certainly lots of natural causes in our environment that we pay attention to that cause cancer. Sunlight. Here in Iowa, we have a big problem with radon as an environmental factor. Do you see a difference in the natural environmental causes of cancer, the way we treat them, look at them, compared to the man-made ones?
Well, sometimes there's more of a continuum rather than an actual real difference. So, for example, there are many chemicals, radon being one, that have and I guess the other ones would be like heavy metals, mercury, cadmium, chromium, lead, that are toxic or even carcinogenic and have a rightful place in the periodic chart of elements. Mostly these are found deep under the ground, and if we don't disturb them, they really aren't natural in the sense that they're not really found in the world of living things in nature. But when we do things like practice hydrofracking, for example, which is this new way of getting getting natural gas out of the ground, and we shatter the bedrock and bring these chemicals up to the surface and then dump them in landfills, we're suddenly transferring inherently naturally toxic chemicals from deep in the geological strata up into the natural world where a lot of us live.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, coal mining is another way that we do this, because coal is naturally contaminated with mercury. And when we shovel it into ovens and light it on fire so we can turn the lights on, we're loading up the atmosphere with mercury. Now, mercury is a natural substance, but normally it's under the ground, not in the atmosphere. And once it's in the atmosphere, it can easily siphon its way up the food chain. And that's why we can't really eat any fish east of the Rocky Mountains anymore. At least women of reproductive age and children are warned against eating sport-caught fish in so many of our rivers. Mercury is part of that story. So I think there's a kind of continuum between so-called natural causes and human-made causes.
So what are you must have thoughts on the large oil spill going on in the Gulf, not only the immediate consequences, because we have that's a fossil fuel coming up there, the consequences longer term for people's health.
Well, I do, of course, and it's a sort of a tragedy unfolding in slow motion. I think that event shows us how the environmental crisis is really two interwoven crises. I think of it as a kind of tree with two tree trunks. One trunk is our dependency on fossil fuels that we use to combust in the form of natural gas, petroleum, or coal, and we use to drive our transportation and energy sectors. And, of course, in doing so, we threaten to collapse our planetary ecosystem due to climate instability because of the buildup of CO2. The other trunk of that tree is that these petrochemicals are sort of naturally toxic, and when they trespass inside of our bodies, They can cause cancer and birth defects, learning disabilities, pregnancy losses, and so forth, asthma. And so soot and benzene and all the other chemicals that are going to be killing wildlife and working their way up the food chain and finding their way into human bodies, that's the other environmental crisis, the way in which petrochemicals are toxic. And so, in a way, our problem is a simple one, even though it sounds overwhelming. And the challenge really is to divorce our economy from its dependency on petrochemicals, both for our energy sectors, but also as a feedstock for the petrochemical industry to make things like plastics and pesticides and so forth. We really need to embrace another source for making stuff. And
We have just a few seconds left. How hopeful are you about our future in these regards?
Oh, I'm very hopeful. I'm a cancer survivor. You know, I learned how to have hope in times of great desperation. And my mom, you know, she had metastatic breast cancer at 44. She's one of 2% of women with that diagnosis who's still alive today. She's a great grandmother. She always told me, don't let them bury you until you're dead. And so I bring that same fighting spirit to the environmental crisis. I think there are so many promises with green chemistry and green engineering. We just need to have the courage to imagine a new kind of future and go after it.
Thank you very much. Author, biologist, cancer survivor Sandra Steingraber, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
An updated edition of Living Downstream has just been published. Sandra Steingraber writes lectures on environmental factors that contribute to reproductive health problems and environmental links to cancer. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt, Catherine Perkins, and Lindsay Moon. Our producer assistant today was Christoph Mai. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.